Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio. In this edition, Papua New Guinea readies itself for national elections. Police in Thailand take special courses to help curb domestic violence. And Australia Coffee taking off big in China. We have this and much more on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. Papua New Guinea's Electoral Commissioner, Andrew Tawan, says a total of 3,435 candidates have nominated for the national elections. This is the highest number of candidates to contrast an election since the first in 1977. Commissioner Tawan says there is also a record number of 135 women candidates. He told Radio Australia's Talk Pixin service that everything is in place for polling. He speaks with Piris Bondjuri.
I was always confident, and I have confidence in my staff, all my election managers and all my staff in the head office, my two deputies, all my directors. I have always have faith in them and trust in them, and I know we have put out a very extensive strategies with the support of the electoral support program funded by the Australian government. And I've always maintained my view that this election we will be prepared, despite what happened in the political cycle, we were confident that we will deliver the elections this year.
You've got polling stations and the polling officials now in a place in all parts of the country, ready for the Saturday's start.
That's correct. All the teams are ready. I had some issues in West Epic when the plane that we chartered to move the ballot papers and the posters, calendar posters and the electoral crash landed at the end of the Wanamu runway. But we managed to get another plane, and move the materials up Green River and Imona and Amanap on time for the election. So I'm pretty confident now that everything is in order, and also received some information or a call from Tari, from the chief executive officer of the Health Treasures Authority, on some issues. But after talking to him, he's very happy, and voting in Tari will commence this Saturday as scheduled. He was a bit concerned about the funding aspect of the election, and I've assured him that the funding for Hela is controlled and managed here in Port Moresby, and we'll be able to clear all the checks by this afternoon.
You have had in the past elections, the electoral or provincial electoral officials been demanding payment before starting the work on the election process. Have you had any instances during this preparation?
Not across the board, but only one or two areas, I think up in the Chiwaka. There were some issues with on probably Southern Highlands. So officers who took part in the enrollment exercises refused to allow us to hold the elections, and I think that was cleared after we made some payments.
Australia and New Zealand, what sort of assistance have they given you?
The Australian government has offered us a huge support in terms of providing the Defence Force, Australian Defence Force, C-130 planes to move our logistics up to the Highlands and also other parts of the country, and also with the manpower under the Australian Civilian Corps, that they have sent up some personnel to help us upskill our own people and build our capacities. But with the extra support from the Australian Civilian Corps, it really helped us move things faster and get things done very quickly. This is the result of the PNG government's Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill's visit to Australia last October, and struck a deal with the Australian Prime Minister, and we now have this support here in terms of manpower and logistics. They own Air Force helicopters. They are going to help us get teams into the polling places in the southern region and the both eastern and western Papua. And we also have the New Zealand government supporting us in terms of marine movement, especially in Bougainville and the Milne Bay Island water. So We are very grateful to the both governments, Australia and New Zealand, in getting the extra movements of people.
Peter Spunjui speaking to the Papua New Guinea Electoral Commissioner, Andrew Tarren. Going beyond law enforcement when it comes to domestic violence. That's the focus of a training session for nearly 300 Thai police candidates that wrapped up in Bangkok. Non-governmental organizations like Hotline Center Foundation say Thai police have traditionally been trained to be sensitive to recognizing gender-sensitive issues like domestic violence. The three-day training course was organized by the Thai police and the United Nations. Nasya Baffin has the story.
In Thailand, a national survey in 2009 found more than 300,000 women faced physical violence from their partners, especially young women aged 15 to 19. But the total number of women facing domestic violence remains unknown. The UN believes the underreporting of domestic violence is a serious problem in all regions of Thailand. Thai police cadets have begun what's being described as the country's first training course on violence against women and girls. The UN Women Thailand Program Manager is Rayaratna Rangsitpol.
Ending violence against women is one of the main areas of Thailand's National Women's Development Plan. So UN Women is supporting that under the overall leadership of Her Royal Highness Princess Pacharakit Diapa as UN Women Goodwill Ambassador. We promote gender-sensitive justice sector and the lawmaking process, and also organize and support public campaign and outreach to enhance awareness and knowledge on this particular issue, particularly among the new generation and the youth.
If this is the first training program of its kind in Thailand, have the police in Thailand not undergone any training at all in domestic violence?
They do have their in their regular curriculum relevant law like the penal code and the existing domestic violence law in the kind of classroom setting. But as we know, violence against women is not a straightforward issue. So this particular training is the first time that they are exposed to listening to former victims of violence. They also learn about the forms and the manifestations of violence against women, that it is not only physical or sexual, but it is also emotional and also institutional.
So both male and female police cadets are involved with the training. More than 280 on the first day, 80 of these students volunteering to continue the training for a second and third day. What type of reactions have you gotten from the cadets?
We actually got some positive and encouraging feedback from them. For instance, one of them said that what he got from the workshop was actually a new perspective, a change of mentality of how domestic violence is not a family matter, it's not a private matter. If there are some women who really suffer from this, then there needs to be something done from the point of the society and from the police. So he said that it has a changed perspective.
The Thai government's national survey suggests it's particularly young women or girls aged 15 to 19 who face violence from their partners. How widespread is the problem of domestic violence against women and girls in Thailand?
Actually, the figure is quite unknown, it's quite young, and this is something that we feel that if we address the young generation, we hope to be able to make changes to the attitudes of the men as well as information to the women as to what they can do if they face with domestic violence and also what kind of support they can get if they actually find themselves in that situation.
Do you think that in Asia-Pacific societies there is still a sense that domestic violence is a family or a private issue that shouldn't be dealt with by public authorities like the police and the government?
We think that it is very important to make sure that the general public and the society at large understand that violence against women is not a private matter. It is actually a public matter, and if we feel that we're an outsider to this problem and we fail to address the issue as a member of the society, then we're part of the violence. We're part of enduring this institution of violence in society.
Armed troops are patrolling the northwest Burmese city of Sitwe after days of sectarian violence that have killed 29 people and displaced 30,000 civilians. Heavy rain kept many residents indoor in the state of Rakhine, and police and aid groups struggled to get food to thousands of residents in the area. Meanwhile, the United Nations Special Rapport on Human Rights in Burma has called on the Burmese government to end the state of emergency as soon as possible to allow better protection of people's rights. Garish Sariwani speaks to the UN Special Envoy on Human Rights in Burma, Thomas Quintana.
Well, I'm critically concerned about the losses of lives, the injuries, the destruction of property going on in Rakhine State, but particularly in northern Rakhine State, where the Muslim community known as Rohingya are based. According to my opinion, this is the population who are most suffering the consequences of this communal violence.
How would you describe the way the Burmese authorities have handled the situation? I mean, human rights groups are saying they've done little to quell the violence.
The government has made legal decisions in the first place by establishing the state of emergency. The state of emergency is contemplated in the constitution, so this is a legal decision, launching then military forces to the region, apparently so far trying to establish order and control the situation. According to the report that I have been receiving, it seems that some members or some part of the police has been acting not in accordance to the orders, maybe compromising with some of the sites and committing some abuses.
That's right. There are reports that security forces were involved in torching houses. Is that your understanding?
Well, I want to be precise on this. My reports indicate that they are the police forces, not from the military, who have been maybe involved in some of these cases. As you may know, it's difficult to really assess in detail the facts. The reports coming from Northern Rakhine State are some of them contradictory. What I have received is that the police may be taking some sides in this conflict, and that's not the way that the police has to be acting to solve and to restore order. Another thing that concerns me, let me add, is that the state of emergency established and ordered by the president is not maintained permanently. The essential of any state of emergency is that it's transitory. So I hope that once the order is restored, the president leaves the state of emergency because, for example, according to the prerogative that the state of emergency gives to the security forces is to arrest people without the intervention of a judge. And this is taking place at this moment. While we are talking, this is taking place in Northern Rakhine State. So people being arrested without knowing where they are, without the intervention of a judge or without the intervention of a counselor, their families without knowing where they are. This is a prerogative of a state of emergency. I hope that as soon as possible, once the order is restored, the state of emergency is lifted by the president.
Now, you've spoken about the need for the government to address the root causes of discrimination against ethnic and religious minorities in Burma. Can you tell us what are these root causes?
If we talk about Rakhine State, and particularly Northern Rakhine State, again, we are referring to the Rohingya community, this Muslim community that, according to the government of Myanmar, are stateless. Basically, this has been a problem in Myanmar who has been there for years. And the problem is that this new civilian government has not taken any decision in respect to addressing comprehensively, politically, the problem of Rohingyas. So I commended the government for taking some other human rights decisions important, like the release of political prisoners, the reforms of the media law, the ceasefire agreements. But I haven't seen, since the government started, any political decision in respect to Rohingyas. And now we are seeing the consequences. This is basically my assessment of the situation that seems to have some common points with other ethnic situations around the country, but the main difference is that here we find the Rohingyas being a stateless community, being a community who have been oppressed by the government, being a community who has been marginalized by the government. This is different from other ethnic situations around the country.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio. Tensions remain high in the Indonesian province of Papua after the police killing last week of an independence activist. Mako Tambuni was shot and killed last Thursday morning in what rights groups have said was a targeted killing. The local police chief denies that Mr. Tambuni was shot while resisting arrest. But the whole event has renewed focus on the question of whether Jakarta has any plans to bring peace to the troubled province. Bill Bainbridge has more.
Mako Tambuni was buried on the weekend after police had initially refused to release his body to his family, then prevented him being buried alongside the grave of another former independence leader. Nonetheless, the funeral drew hundreds of mourners under the watchful eye of security forces. But the situation around the capital, Jayapura, remains tense, says Ferry Marasan from the Papua-based human rights NGO, ELSUM.
Operation by PNI and police still go on until today. They were in all place around Jayapura and Wayana.
So there's a very large police presence on the streets there.
Yes. Yes, not only police, but the PNI also, the military also.
Mako Tambuni's coffin was draped in a West Papuan flag, the symbol of his quest for independence. But independence remains a distant dream. Sofyan Yeoman is the chairman of the Baptist Churches of Papua. He's currently in Jakarta lobbying foreign embassies to help bring about international intervention in West Papua.
Absolutely, absolutely, brother. And we did the neutral party mediate for two groups, the Indonesian government and the West Papua representative, to come to the negotiation table to talk peacefully or genuine. This is the main demand, the Papuans.
But what are the prospects for international intervention? Not good, according to Papua specialist Dr. Richard Chevelle.
The president's recent statement saying that the killings weren't on all that larger scale, we shouldn't worry about them too much, is certainly not the sort of statement that a political leader would make who would welcome international intervention.
And do you think that's because he's not being put under any kind of pressure by the international community? Is he being asked to deal with this situation?
There have been, I think, quite a number of visits to Jakarta by Secretary Clinton, by Ban Ki-moon and others, where it appears that Papua has been raised, and the visits that I have in mind of several months took place several months before the recent spate of killings. So you know, clearly diplomats, foreign, international leaders are raising the issue of Papua with President Yudhoyono, but so far the president hasn't given any indications that he's at all receptive to doing much about it. And as you will recall, that he did announce November of last year of negotiations of a dialogue with Papuans for a peaceful resolution of the conflict in Papua. There have subsequently been at least two meetings with Papuan church leaders, but over the last several months there doesn't seem to have been much progress.
And it would appear from what the human rights groups are saying that Detachment 88, the anti-terror force which received some training from Australia, was involved in the killing of the independence leader. In your view, is that an appropriate use of this anti-terror squad?
I think that, you know, clearly that squad has been used both in Papua and also in neighbouring Maluku province, particularly in Ambon. Whether it's appropriate, once that training is provided, then the ability of the Australian and American governments to control or to influence how those troops are used is clearly limited. And I think that that's undoubtedly part of the policy calculations that are made when that training is provided.
A French architect with alleged ties to Chinese politician Bo Xilai has been arrested in Cambodia. That's according to the French embassy and police. French officials say they are trying to clarify the reason for the arrest of Patrick de Villers. He is reported to have close business ties with Mr. Bo, in particular his wife, Guo Kailai. Liam Cochran speaks to the Australia Network's correspondent in Cambodia, Hue Ferntay.
Well, what we do know is that the Cambodian police 2 weeks ago arrested this architect. For what charges, we don't know, but they say it was done in cooperation with the Chinese and that the Chinese have requested that he be extradited to China because of offenses here, offenses that he is alleged to have committed. The Cambodian police have not said or revealed what these offenses allegedly are, and the French embassy are also trying to verify that.
And what's the link to Bo Xilai, the controversial and scandal-plagued Chinese politician?
Well, what we do know about this French architect is that he had business dealings with Bo Xilai's wife, who is a successful lawyer and also a businesswoman as well. And reporters have been able to track down this now-defunct business that the both of them had in the UK. And also this French architect is supposedly helped Bo Xilai redesign the city of Dalian, and he was in charge over there in the 90s. But beyond that, we really don't know much more about this French architect. And in fact, he has been described as probably the most mysterious person in this whole Bo Xilai affair. And it just adds a little bit more intrigue to a scandal, to a political scandal, which is arguably one of the biggest to hit China in decades.
And what is the latest on Bo Xilai and the scandal surrounding him, perhaps from a Chinese perspective?
Well, until now, we don't know what Bo Xilai is being investigated for. I mean, all we do know officially is that he has damaged the party's image, the image of the Communist Party, and that he was sacked from his position because of serious discipline violations. But until now, we don't know what those violations are. He hasn't been seen in public ever since his very public downfall in March, and ever since he was very publicly rebuked by the Chinese premier at the end of the National People's Congress. And there's speculation out there that he hasn't been seen because he's under house arrest. We also haven't seen his wife. We don't know where she is, but she has been named as a key suspect in the murder of an English businessman whom she also apparently had business dealings with. And she is not the only suspect, though. One of the guys who used to work for the family, the Bo Xilai family, has also been named as a suspect. But beyond that, this whole affair is still very much ridden with a lot of mystery and intrigue. And because there's so much unknown, there's so much uncertainty over here, it just feeds into the whole rumor mill. And it just keeps getting bigger and bigger.
Hue Ferntay, the Australian Network correspondent in Cambodia, speaking with Liam Cochran. And finally, Australian coffee farmers are expecting a bump crop this year, and they'll be looking offshore to sell a lot of their product. Growers say there is a growing demand for coffee, and in surprising places, like traditionally tea-loving China. Lauren Day has more.
Few people probably realise the hard yards behind their daily cuppa. In the early hours before your first morning cup, the McLaughlin family are out growing, tending, picking or roasting coffee.
I'm often out there about 7:30 in the morning roasting, so there's a lot of people just getting out of bed, and I've roasted the first 40, 60 kilos.
Aileen McLaughlin says they've been in the bean business for 25 years, and this year they're looking forward to one of their best crops yet.
We're hoping for a bumper crop, double definitely on what we had last year.
They're hoping to produce enough coffee to make around 7 million cups, or one for every three Australians. But farm manager Mark McLaughlin says not many of the Australian beans will be enjoyed by coffee lovers down under.
If you look at Australia coffee on the world coffee market, we do produce some of the finest coffee grown in the world. The care attention, the growing climate and conditions are very favourable, particularly in Mareeba. And the Tablelands region is perfect altitude and everything else to produce fantastic coffee. But because we produce such a high-quality coffee. We sell at about 10 times the world coffee market price.
Some baristas do still favour the local drop, like Cairns Cafe manager Sean Marshall.
The beans that we get are roasted, they're put in a bag and they're delivered to us within a few days. The other beans are roasted in Italy and then shipped over. I don't know how long that takes. So the freshness aspect has got to far outweigh any kind of economic sort of costs. Yeah.
But he's in the minority, and the McLaughlins say they sell the vast majority of their product offshore. Europe is predictably the biggest market, with the European Union importing around 50% of the entire global coffee supply. But there's a new market emerging. One of the biggest nations of tea drinkers has moved to the dark side, and Chinese investors are discussing a franchise deal with Australian growers. Mark McLaughlin says it's an exciting time for the industry in far north Queensland, where around 75% of Australian coffee is produced.
Any new interest is great. And we're all the time we are looking to, you know, push more and more of our product domestically around Australia as well.
Aileen McLaughlin is not surprised the appeal of the Aussie bean is spreading.
Never get sick of the flavour or the smell of coffee. I absolutely adore it. It's just beautiful. When you're roasting it and you go through the different stages of the roasting, you get that really nice nutty smell, and then you get the cooked coffee smell. Absolutely beautiful.
And with that report from Lauren Day, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you'd like to let us know what you think of the program or have any story suggestions, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple, pcj@pcjmedia.com. You can also catch all past editions by going to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. Once again, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. So on behalf of the whole team, this is Keith Powell wishing you well, hoping that you join us again very soon. Bye, everyone.
Son of PCJ.